compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, welcome back. Thanks again for listening. 888-914-9149 is the number. If you want to send me an email, just go over to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, and click on connect, and you can send me an email. Here's one that comes in from Laura, and she's listening on the Relevant Radio app. She says, I just want to say thank you, Patrick, for your excellent description of the scapular and metals in general as a sacramental. This explanation was exactly what I needed to hear. I'm so glad I was listening when the caller asked the question in the second quarter of hour three. That's a few shows ago. She says, I struggle with the temptation to superstition, so I have not been wearing the brown scapular that my sister-in-law gave me years ago. Now I finally think I can start wearing it without being superstitious about it and with the right attitude. Maybe our Holy Mother prompted me to listen to your show at this hour today as a gentle nudge. So God bless Catholic Radio and God bless you, Patrick. Laura. Well, Laura, thank you. I'm so happy to know that that's the case. So maybe just to kind of recap, a scapular, a miraculous metal, your rosary beads, holy water, blessed candles, etc. You should never look at them in a superstitious way. They're sacramentals, not sacraments. Sacraments give you sanctifying grace. It's the power of Christ working in the sacrament. Sacramentals are different. Sacramentals, crucifixes, Bibles, holy water, beads, genuflecting, that's a sacramental. Blessing yourself in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, that's a sacramental. Receiving a blessing from a priest, that's a sacramental. It's a long list. Sacramentals, the analogy that I've always found helpful is that a sacramental is like a tugboat. And back in the olden days, before cruise ships got these really fancy propellers and engines that could push the boat sideways. They can do that now, but back in the olden days when ships couldn't do that, they would have tugboats that would come alongside and start pushing the big ocean liner in the direction it's supposed to go so it can get out of the harbor and get out into the open sea. Well, sacramentals are kind of like those tugboats. They're not giving sanctifying grace in the soul as the sacraments do. But as sacramentals, what they do is they nudge your soul, so to speak, in the right direction so that you are more able to receive sanctifying grace from the Lord through the means that it comes to you. So with the sacraments as an example. But you're not receiving sanctifying grace when you kiss a crucifix or when you genuflect or when you make the sign of the cross. But what you're doing is that you're, by making use of these sacramentals, you are now becoming more able, more, maybe you could think of it as more capacity to receive more grace. They don't give you the grace, but they make you more prepared to receive it. And if we can switch analogies now, let's use an analogy of athletics. And you know that for athletes of all types, but athletes in general, they need a lot of lung capacity to be able to breathe in a lot of air to oxygenate the blood. So while they're running or jumping or whatever it is they're doing for sports, they need as much oxygen in their blood as possible. So the more you work out, the more you run, the more you lift weights and all the other things that athletes do to prepare, the bigger your lung capacity gets. The bigger your lung capacity, the more air you can breathe in, means the better oxygenated your blood's going to be, which means you'll perform better as an athlete. So the sacramentals are not giving you the oxygen. That would be analogous to the sanctifying grace that's coming to you, say, through the Holy Eucharist, as an example. But what the sacramentals are doing, it's like the working out, the lifting of weights. It's the running, and it's all the things that you do so that you build a greater lung capacity so that you can receive more grace. Think of them that way. So this is why, just as your wedding ring, it doesn't make you married. It's a sign of your marriage. It's a symbol, lets you and other people know that you're off the market. You're dedicated to one person. But if you were to slip your wedding ring off, now obviously that has certain connotations that could be very negative. If a married man or a married woman slips her wedding ring, if she slips her wedding ring off before she goes out, that's questionable. You know, why is she doing that? You might ask yourself, what's the motive behind that? But just the very fact of slipping your wedding ring off doesn't suddenly now make you unmarried. And the same is true when you wear, as a sign of devotion to Our Lady, the brown scapular of Our Lady of Mount Carmel, as an example, or the miraculous medal. I wear a miraculous medal on a chain around my neck. I've worn a miraculous medal for many, many, many years. But I know that when I take the miraculous medal off, set it down to the side, either take a shower or go swimming or, you know, whatever it is I need to do that I don't need to have that medal on me, I know I'm not like suddenly in danger. I'm not vulnerable. I'm not, you know, it's not like a force field went down or something like that. It's not like when I put the miraculous medal on again, suddenly now the force field is back up. That would be superstitious thinking. And that's not what the church teaches. It's easy for us as human beings to sort of fall into that mindset if we're not careful. It's a sign of devotion. It's intended to be a reminder to you and other people of your faith in the Lord, your trust in His mercy and forgiveness, His grace. And in the case of Mary and the saints, it's also a reminder to you of not only their love for you and their desire to pray for you, as it says in Hebrews chapter 12, we're surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, as if they're in heaven cheering you on, and they are. But it's also a reminder to you when you feel it under your clothing or you hear it rustling around or the chain makes a sound or something. It's a reminder to you of your devotion to Our Lady. And that's the proper way to approach these things. They're not magical. They're not good luck charms. They don't have power within them. You know, some say that holy water has the power to chase away devils. I do believe that because holy water is a thing now that has been exercised and it has been blessed and set apart for holy uses. So I have every reason to believe that the devil doesn't like holy water. So bless your house liberally with holy water. But never look at these things superstitiously. And I think that's the key to what we were talking about, or what she was talking about in that letter. Let's go to Becky quickly in Pennsylvania. Hi, Becky.
Hi, Patrick. How are you?
I am well, thank you.
I was listening to Angela, the teacher who just called in,
yes,
about her middle school students. And as I was listening to her, I had a very short thought.
Okay.
I was a middle school kid who went through my parents' divorce. Mm. And I think it's amazing that they're hashing it out with her. But the thought that I had was just that as I pray the rosary now every day, I'm a revert. I came back about 6 years ago.
Wonderful.
When I'm praying the sorrowful mysteries, and I'm starting with the agony and ending with the crucifixion,
mm-hmm,
I feel very personally that Jesus feels all of that. You know, He told us He'd be with us always. Mm-hmm. And I would just encourage her to encourage the kids to begin praying the rosary and allowing themselves to meditate on the fact that Jesus does feel that. I just really think that's true. I don't know if you agree, but...
Well, tell me more about that. So I want to make sure I understand. So you're saying that when you meditate on the sorrowful mysteries of the rosary, that what is it that you feel that Jesus is feeling?
I just feel He feels my pain and my suffering. I feel that He carried... It's a mystery, of course, but He carried, mm-hmm, all of it. So
yes,
even though you, and it helped me that you said, you know, it's not necessary for Him to have experienced everything,
mm-hmm,
you know, the pain of His parents' divorce. It's not necessary. That really helped me to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would also maybe just talk to those kids. It helps me when I pray the rosary, especially the sorrowful mysteries, I feel Him so personally with me.
That's beautiful.
During, you know, sharing my own pain.
Yes. In a way... Would it be fair to say something like this, Becky, that in a way, maybe at the same time even, you're kind of like Simon of Cyrene helping Jesus carry his cross by thinking about what he went through, and he's like, in a way, kind of like Simon of Cyrene helping you carry your cross? He's not Simon of Cyrene, but in other words, he's kind of helping you carry your cross. Would that be a fair way to put it?
Yeah, exactly, and I've had that exact thought many times as I pray the sorrowful mysteries. For me, it sounds weird, but they're my favorite.
Yeah. You know, I have a similar proclivity for the sorrowful mysteries as well. I pray them, all of them, but I find that the sorrowful mysteries have a kind of special emotional pull for me. Maybe that's what you're talking about for you, because mm-hmm. of the
yeah, it is, and I just agony. Feel like the kids, if they really understand and feel that Jesus is sharing the pain they're going through right now with their, you know, with their parents' divorce.
Yeah,
I'm an adult and I still feel that pain.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a book that would really speak to you, I think, Becky. It's a book called Primal Loss. Have you ever heard of that book?
Yeah, I've read it.
Oh, okay. Well, then you know. Was it helpful to you to read it, or did it make matters worse for you? Did it make your pain greater?
No, it really helps, because it helped me understand that I'm not alone in feeling it. Yeah. It's almost like what you were saying with Simon of Cyrene. It's when you read about other people's pain, you're able to kind of, you know, pray for them, mm-hmm. for their pain, and it's like you're sharing it in a way, because our prayers are really just, we're lifting up each other's intentions. And when you read about the pain of others, I think you are able to incorporate that into your own prayers.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. I think it was Peter Kraft, Becky, that used an analogy, and I don't know if I have it exactly right, but worse to the effect that, let's say that you're stuck in a snowstorm on the side of the road in your car, and you're stuck, you're snowed in, you can't go anywhere, and it's cold. Maybe the person who comes to you can't get you out of the snow, he can't tow your car away and get you out of the snowstorm, but if she comes and sits with you and shares that difficult experience with you, you know, that's really a good thing. Even if it doesn't fix the problem, being there to help you go through it can be so powerful. And often that's what Jesus does. It, in God's will, he doesn't always, it's not in his plan to fix the problem the way we would want it fixed, but he will come and be there with us in the midst of the problem and share it with us and encourage us, which I find personally very, very encouraging, honestly.
Yeah, me too.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate it very much. The book I recommended to Becky that she had already read is called Primal Loss by Layla Miller, and it's a compendium of people whose parents got divorced, often when they were kids, sometimes when they were adults, and they just share their own stories. They share their own pain, and it's one testimony after another, after another, after another. And I really think that that's an important book. If you know somebody who's contemplating divorce, hand them that book. Because, especially if they have children, they're going to think twice, hopefully, about what they're doing. It's like grabbing a hand grenade and pulling the pin and then walking away. The effect it has on the children, the devastating effect it has on children, is just incalculable. Well, let's move on to other things. Let's go to Conan now in Jacksonville Beach, Florida. Hello, Conan.
Hi, Patrick. On the topic that you've been discussing around helping the homeless, I struggle with that, because I'm wondering how you weigh out the dangers involved as well. In my neighborhood, we have a small homeless population, but they're known to be on drugs. They're known to be, you know, dangerous at points, and have stolen bicycles and things from our neighborhoods and such. And I feel compelled to give them food or money sometimes, but then I also have to weigh out, is it dangerous? Will they try to grab me? Will they try to, you know, I'm often with my children when we're around town. And I want to show the example, and we've done things in the past. We've have, you know, handed them food when we can, but I think there's also an inherent danger with some of these folks, either mm-hmm. being on drugs or a bit knowing that they're mentally ill. So I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on what the balance is.
Well, I'm with you, and I share your concern, especially if you're with your wife or your children and your wife. You have an obligation to protect them. And in a situation like that where people are erratic and unpredictable, anything could happen. And we see stories all the time of people who attack others. I mean, look at these terrible subway shovings going on in Manhattan, where someone's just waiting for the train to show up and somebody behind them pushes them onto the tracks and kills them. So crazy stuff happens, no doubt. So it seems to me that there's a golden mean here, and that is that when the situation is not unsafe for you or your family, then that would be a time, it seems, that you could safely do something to help. But if you get the impression that this person might be violent or might try something crazy, you're not obligated to then and there help that person under those circumstances. If you can, great. But if you sense that there's some danger to your family, then better that you protect your family and then circle back at some point and try to help out. So I think it's sort of on a case-by-case basis, if you ask me.
Yeah, I think the challenge is you know, some of the stories I heard today is you handed somebody some money and then they reacted, right? So you don't know how they're going to react, even though they seem harmless. And then the other point is, you know, and some of them are quite honest with you. They want the money to go buy beer, to go buy, you know, whatever they're doing. So it's tough. You want to help, but at the same token, you have to be careful. And are you just enabling them?
It can be enabling, and that's a bad thing. So if you know that by giving this money or giving this guy $5, he's going to go buy beer or shoot up or something like that, then it seems like you have a kind of built-in reason to not help in that way. But you could say, hey, you know, have you had lunch yet? Well, no, I haven't. Well, let me buy you lunch. You know, I mean, there are ways to do that. There are ways to help that don't involve giving cash. And sometimes giving cash is the wrong thing, as you're saying.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you. Interesting stuff, that's for sure. Let's go to, you know what? Let's go to a break. And those of you who are holding, just stand by, please, because I want to be able to give you more time. And if we take a break now, I can do that. The number to dial is 888-914-9149. We're just going to take a quick time out. I'll come right back to the phone calls right after this. This hour is sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare, the first to offer comprehensive sharing for prescription medications. Check now to see how much you can save. Go to CatholicHealthShare.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Let's keep this thing going. Let's get the road show back on the road, 888-914-9149. We'll go to Rogan Heights, California, talk to John. Good morning, John.
Hey, Patrick, how you doing? Nice to hear from you again.
Thank you.
To be the chef for the Carmelite Sisters in Alhambra.
So right. You're mama's boy, right?
Yeah, there you go. Catholic mama's boy.
That's the one. I remember, yeah.
Wow, good memory. Yes. So I never told you, but my dad's Protestant.
Okay.
You know, and I'm Catholic, so sometimes we have discussions. So he had an interesting question for me.
Yeah.
So I guess the question is for both of us. It's beautiful that people are calling about suffering. So Jesus suffered on the cross for us. He suffered for our sins. So my dad asked, in purgatory, do we have to suffer, you know, for the sins that we have caused? If so, then why did Jesus suffer on the cross for us? Why do we still have to suffer when Jesus already suffered for us? Why do we have to suffer again?
Right. Well,
does that make sense?
Yeah, it sure does. Yeah. So let's explain it this way. When you commit a sin, there are two components to the sin that we should take into account. One is the penalty that's due to sin, and the other is the effect of the sin, how the sin affects you, how it affects other people. So we can start by saying that the penalty due to sin, which is hell, can only be paid by Jesus. So his death on the cross, his suffering and his death on the cross paid the penalty, paid the price for your sins and mine, and the sins of the whole world. So when we consider the sin, we have to, number one, say that Jesus' death on the cross is sufficient. He says it is finished. When he died on the cross, he bowed his head and gave up the spirit, and he said, it is finished, meaning that there's nothing left to pay. And you and I can't pay for our sins. We can't pay the penalty. Only Jesus Christ can do that for us. So that's the first thing we have to keep in mind. The second thing, however, is that sins have an effect. They cause, you might say, collateral damage, both spiritually and physically. I'll give you an example. Maybe you can talk to your dad about this. say, let's say that a let's make it a man. Let's say that a man becomes he becomes sinful sexually, and we don't have to stipulate what those sins might be, but whatever it is that he's doing winds up catching a very serious disease as a result of that. And it might even be a life-threatening disease, okay, an STD. Now, he comes to his senses and he says, oh, I shouldn't be doing this. This is terrible. I'm sorry, Lord. I don't want to do this anymore. I'm truly sorry. He goes to confession, and he is forgiven, and Jesus paid the price for his sin, and he's forgiven now, and maybe he's going to go to heaven when he dies, but he still has that disease. So the fact that Jesus forgives him of his sins, the fact that Jesus pays the penalty for his sins by his death on the cross, doesn't mean that the disease goes away, because that's what we call a temporal effect due to sin. Another way of thinking of it would be, let's say somebody's reputation gets destroyed. He may be sorry for his sins, and he may be forgiven for his sins, and Jesus pays the price for his sins, but one of the effects of his sin is that his reputation has now been destroyed. There's another example. Now let's take it into the spiritual realm. Sin involves forgiveness, obviously, for those who desire it, for those who ask the Lord for forgiveness, but it also involves justice. So God gives us mercy. He also gives us justice. Justice is where you get what you deserve. Mercy is where you don't get what you deserve. So by being forgiven of your sin, you don't get what you deserve, because Jesus applies his grace of forgiveness to you and you're not punished for it. But in justice, there is a certain, you might say, restitution necessary. So if I may use another example, let's say that you figured out some way to steal a $1,000 item at Best Buy. You get home, you are sorry for what you did. You have remorse, and you go back, and you say to the manager of the store, I'm turning myself in. I'm really sorry. I stole this thing, cost $1,000, and I can't live with myself, and I'm sorry. I want to turn myself in. So the manager says, all right, well, because you did that, I'm not going to call the police. I'm not going to press charges. You're not going to go to jail. That penalty that you would otherwise have had is not going to happen. And you say, oh, great, thank you. And you turned around to walk away, and the manager says what? The manager says, well, you have to return what you stole. You can't keep it. Oh, really? Yeah, of course. I mean, I'm forgiving you. I'm not calling the cops. You're not going to go to jail. But in justice, you have to make restitution. You got to return it. Oh, well, I sold it on eBay. Well, you got to pay for it. So there's that dimension as well. That when you do penance, and this gets us to the question of purgatory, you can either experience your purification in this life, or you can experience it in purgatory on your way to heaven. Purgatory is only for those people who are destined for heaven, if they need to go there. Those who are going to hell will never spend any time in purgatory. It's only for those who are saved. But the main thing to remember here is that restitution, that purification of the way in which sin has affected you. If you think of it as a stain, or you could think of it as a scar, I think it was Archbishop Fulton Sheen who used the analogy of, it's like committing a sin is like hammering a nail into a piece of wood. When the Lord forgives you, it's like pulling the nail out, which is great, but there's still a hole there. So purgatory is where the Lord repairs the damage that was caused by your sin. He's not paying, the penalty's already paid for it. Jesus did that. But the effects of the sin remain and have to be purified. And if you want a verse that will help you talk about this with your father, John, I would read 1 Corinthians chapter 3, beginning in verse 10, where he says, like a wise master builder, I was building on this foundation of Jesus Christ. And he talks about how this man whose life is revealed on the day that his life is revealed, that's the day of judgment, the day that he dies, Hebrews 9:27, it says a man is appointed to die once, and then comes the judgment. So he's talking about, this is after his death, he's now being judged, his life is being revealed, and he says it will be revealed with fire. And the fire, he says, will test the quality of each one's work. And he talks about the works of his life as gold, silver, and precious stones, or wood, hay, and straw. And he says the fire will burn off. It's going to purge off the wood, the hay, and the straw, the things that are flammable. They get burned off. And he says this man suffers as these things are burned away. And then he says he will be saved, but only as though passing through fire. So although the term purgatory isn't used there, the description is really clear. This takes place after death, but before you're entering into heaven. And this purification that God is giving with this fire is burning off those things that are not compatible with an all-holy God. Revelation 21:27 says, nothing unclean can enter heaven. So this is God's way to finalize the purification that's necessary so that you can be completely pure and ready to see God face to face. Remember, Jesus said, blessed are the pure of heart, for they will see God. Which means, obviously, that if you're not pure of heart, you will not see God. And so until that time comes when you've been completely purified, you need to wait a little bit, and that's the biblical doctrine of purgatory. John, great talking to you. I'm really glad you called, and I hope you're doing well. Let's go to Hunter now in Merrill, Wisconsin. Hi, Hunter. Hello, Hunter. There we go. Hi.
Hi. So I was just calling. I'm currently a student at UW-Madison, and there's lots of pro-choice protesters right now. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are, if you had any tips of just fruitful steps to take with them outside of just like praying for them, what are like some action steps to take to make change?
Yeah. So there are a lot of things you can do. One thing would be get a book. I'm sure as a college student, you're buried in books, but a book that I think is helpful is called Tactics by Greg Kokel, K-O-U-K-L. And it's a book that shows you how to deal with these kinds of situations and not get put on the defensive. So if you want, a methodology, that's a very good book. If you want a video on how you can do that, Ray Comfort, who is actually a notorious anti-Catholic, he's a very interesting guy, but he is, I think he's a New Zealander, if I'm not mistaken. He has a video, he's got a lot of videos, but he's got one that's called 180. And if you go to, go to YouTube and just look up 180, Ray Comfort, he's out on, I don't know, it's like Santa Monica Beach or someplace in Southern California, and he's dealing with all kinds of flotsam and jetsam of human beings and people who are everything from freaky looking to pretty normal looking and everyone in between. But he's talking to them about Hitler and the Jews. Now, he's leading up to the issue of abortion, but they don't know it. And so in this video, which is a series of interviews that he's having with different people. I mean, the guy's really effective. I have to give him credit. Maybe if I could ever have a purpose-driven cup of coffee with Ray Comfort, maybe I could turn him around and get him into the Catholic Church. You never know. But in the meantime, what he shows you in this video about how to talk to people who are pro-abortion is to come at it from a direction that they're not expecting. And what you see is some of these people have a change of heart when they realize that on the one hand, if they say, no, it's wrong for Hitler to kill this group of people just because he found them inconvenient and undesirable, how you can take something like that, that the people that you're talking to are likely to say, no, that was wrong, and then show them the parallels between that and abortion, or the same with slavery, and show how if it's wrong and evil for some people to say, well, the Constitution says I can own slaves, or the Supreme Court said I can own slaves. It doesn't matter, even if it says that on paper, even if the law says you can own slaves, you really can't own slaves. It's wrong. It's racist. You should not do it. It should be condemned. It should be stood up against. So those are some of the things that you can try as well. The movie's called 180, and you'll find it on YouTube. Hope that helps. Thank you. Let's go to Christine now in Fox Valley, Wisconsin. Hello, Christine.
Hi, Patrick. I want to tell you how nice it is for me to be able to get my dishes done and learn something. I appreciate that. I
my
do my
pleasure.
Dishes to you most days, so that takes the sting out of the chore. I wanted to share just a little bit about my husband and I have been blessed with 10 children. Many of them are adults now. We still have a kindergartner. And a number of years ago, when our youngest at the time was about 10 months old, my husband was a police officer, sheriff's deputy, and we felt called to go to serve in a mission that was looking for an executive director. And we actually moved our whole family there and lived there for almost 8 years and welcomed homeless and hungry people and had a free clinic. And what I wanted to share about all of that, besides it was a huge blessing in our life, it was transformative to our whole family, is people calling about their loved ones and what to do for them and who are struggling with homelessness and addiction and even mental health issues. And from our perspective as a place that received guests who were struggling, we were probably much more effective than family members. And that's just the nature of the beast. Family members will often fail in trying to convince a loved one because they have so much emotion and they're close to the situation.
When you say that, I'm not sure what you mean by that. Family members are the ones most often to do what?
They're not as likely to convince a loved one to go to a homeless shelter or to seek recovery or to respond to some of the services that are out and about. Now, our mission was Roman Catholic, and so we had strict guidelines, no alcohol, no smoking on the campus and things like that. Not every place is like that, but one of the downsides to what our experience was were well-meaning family members who would come and say, my brother is this and he needs this and I want to bring him here. It rarely ever worked to bring someone to us.
So tell me, I know there's an important point here somewhere. How would you summarize the point that you're making, Christine?
The point I'm making is that family members have a very important job to play in prayer and encouragement. But outsiders sometimes are better at ministering to their loved ones. People are well-meaning and they want to get their brother into treatment or their father or their uncle or whoever it is. But encouraging them to come on their own, and if someone can respond on their own, it's always going to be more successful than if someone is dragged there. We would have moms call and say, this, I want my son to come to you. Can I send him to you? And we would always say, we're willing to have a conversation with that person, but in the end, it has to be their decision. So that's what I'm getting at. And family members have so much history and baggage with individuals. Oftentimes people burn their bridges and they can't go back to their family of origin because, you know, they've burned all those bridges. And sometimes coming to a place like we were able to minister in, it was a fresh start, and we didn't have all that emotional baggage. So we just saw the person as the person coming in need and presented things to them and invited them. So I heard a lot of pain in voices about siblings and relatives who struggled. And, I mean, we took 9 kids to work in this mission, and our children learned a lot. They were never counselors or anything like that, but they, you know, learned to stock shelves and receive people and decorate and serve at meals and things like that, but they were never counselors. And so,
I understand what you're saying. So in other words, what I'm interpreting your comment to mean is that sometimes or maybe even often, if you're the family member and a loved one is now living homeless, you may not be the one he will listen to or she will listen to just because of family weirdness and burned bridges, etc. So that other people who are not family members and there is no baggage, they're in a better position often to speak the truth in a way that the person will be willing to hear because there's no family baggage. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And family always wants to be the one, and we feel failed and we feel like we didn't do enough or we should do more, or I heard the word enabling being used. And we were really strict about, you have food, you have clothing, you have shelter, you have health care. We're providing, those needs are here for you. If you can abide by the no smoking rule, the no alcohol rule, the no chemical rule, those things are available to you. But if you can't, then we have to end our relationship. And that was easier for us to do because we were not their mother, their father.
Right. Unfortunately, I've got to take a break. Thanks, Christine. That's an amazing story. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
You want to see some funny mom humor? Check out my Twitter feed, at Patrick Madrid. I won't even try to explain it to you. It's right up at the top. You'll see it. There's a Visa card in the picture. Whoever that mom is, she's smart. Check it out. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Natalie now in Hayward, California. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, good morning. Patrick, I've been really heavy in my mind trying to figure out, what do you do when your godparents you've chosen for your children promised to be in the faith, went through confirmation classes, got their certificates, and no longer a practicing Catholic? Mm-hmm. Can you switch godparents? What can you do? What do you do?
Yeah, Nancy and I have been in that very situation. So without going into any unnecessary detail for the sake of the people involved, there was a situation where the godfather just stopped practicing the faith and went way in a bad direction. So what we were left with was, all right, how do you replace that godfather? And strictly speaking, the answer, as I understand it, is no. I mean, that person was the godfather and she was the godmother. And even though they fell away from a practice of the faith, or at least he did, he's still a godfather. He's kind of a derelict godfather in a way. But what you can do, even though it's not going to be an official godparent, you can say to another couple, would you like to fulfill the role of godfather, kind of an unofficial godparent role? Would you like to do that? We would love to invite you to have that role in an unofficial way, if you want to, so that if anything should happen to us, or you see some need as the son or daughter grows older, where you can help to steer him in the right direction, to help him or her stay strong in the faith, you can certainly do that. And so practically speaking, okay, that would be like getting another set of godparents, but it wouldn't be officially another set of godparents. It'd be more in the spirit of things. You could do that.
I see.
You sound perplexed and troubled.
I'm climbing up a hill with my stroller, my baby.
Oh.
I took on exercise.
Good for you.
But I listened to you. I relate to the other lady washing dishes. I do everything with you guys on the radio. I recommend you guys to everyone.
Thank you.
You have been an enormous stepping stone to strengthening my faith, and it's just miraculous.
I'm so happy to hear that, Natalie. How many children do you have?
4.
And how old are they, if you don't mind my asking?
My eldest, she is 17. My 3 boys, 5, 4, and 2.
That's great. So the 2-year-old must be in the stroller that you're pushing uphill.
That's right, and he loves it. I ask him. He high-fives me at the end of the road when we make it. He's great.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I'm happy I can take a walk with you and your family. That makes me happy.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Natalie.
I'm happy too.
I hope you don't have a sink full of dishes to go home to.
I sure do.
Uh-oh.
But this
have the kids
the
help
energy.
You. Tell your 17-year-old to get busy and do those dishes.
Well, she's another story.
Well, I'm glad that Relevant Radio and I in particular can be with you on your journeys. And I'm glad it's good exercise for you mentally and spiritually as well as physically. Thanks, Natalie. Let's go to Jose now in Brookfield, Illinois. Hi, Jose.
How you doing, Patrick? Viva Cristo Rey, Patrick.
Viva!
Awesome. I just had a question. My sister-in-law, you know, she was
telling my wife, and, you know, I hear the whole conversation in regards to her tying her tube. She's a practicing Catholic.
Okay.
And I was just wondering, what's your intake or your answer to that? And I just want to say, hi, Cyrus. I listen to you guys every day on my AirPods to work.
Thank you.
You know, while I'm on the highway and stuff like that. You guys have been a great inspiration.
Thank you.
Also, and I can relate so much to the last caller. But basically, that was my question in regards to practicing Catholic tying their tubes.
Got it. So she's a practicing Catholic, meaning that what? She goes to Mass on Sunday. She receives the sacraments. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
And,
yes.
And she's a childbearing age woman, so she's not getting a hysterectomy due to, let's say, oh, I mean, I know that getting your tubes tied is not the same thing as a hysterectomy, but it's not because she's past menopause or anything. She's young enough where she still could have children, right?
That is correct, Patrick.
Okay. Yeah, so what I would tell her gently and respectfully would be, you know, this is not something you should do. It's a serious sin because, number one, it's a form of mutilation. It's an unnecessary thing. It's different than if you needed to have, you know, a body part removed because of disease. That's different. This is not that. So if her reproductive system is working normally and it's not like something has to be operated on to save her health, it's just because she doesn't want to have any more children, then I would say there are far better ways to go about it than that. And remember that by doing this, you're committing a serious sin because you're mutilating your body and you're also doing something to your body that would prevent the possibility of the transmission of life. Now, that, of course, is why she's doing it, or her motive behind it. But you can say that God has a method that he himself designed that doesn't involve mutilating your body, and that is to observe the cycle that a woman has every month, and it's called, for short, NFP, stands for Natural Family Planning, and her local parish will have NFP couples there who can explain to her and her husband how this works. It's not really very complicated, and it would involve typically using some different observational methods, and that could also include, often it does, taking your temperature, and then charting these things on a chart month after month so that within a period of time, maybe 2-3 months, you have a really clear idea based upon these observation methods of when ovulation takes place. And ovulation is when the fertile period is at its peak. And it differs. Different women have different, you know, statistics when it comes to their own cycle, but it would be for a time of maybe, say, 5 days. And then using this methodology, the couple can then say, all right, during this time of the month when fertility is at its peak and the likelihood of conception is at its peak, we just simply avoid marital intimacy during this time. The problem with what she's contemplating doing is that she has no intention, and this may simply be because no one's ever explained it to her. But when a couple uses, whether it's contraception, like a barrier or a chemical or a surgery or in some other way trying to frustrate the possibility of God blessing the couple with a child, what happens is they're making use of marital intimacy purely for the pleasure. Now, it is very pleasurable, as married people know, and it's a wonderful and important part of marriage. But if you're making use of marital intimacy solely for the pleasure, that's sinful because that's hedonism. That'd be the analogy I often use is if you're eating just for the pleasure of the food and then you go in the other room and barf it all back up again and then you belly back up to the table and eat more food, well, we would call that an eating disorder. There'd be a psychological problem there. But anyone can realize that is bad for you, and it's really destructive if you're eating for the sake of the pleasure and you're trying to avoid the responsibility that goes with that. You have the need to eat, and God made food in such a way that it is very pleasurable for us. Not as pleasurable as sexual activity, but it is pleasurable in its own way. And so we need to stay alive. And so God incentivized us to stay alive by making taste buds and ways for us to enjoy the food that we eat. And that's how it should be. But if you were to simply eat the food just for the pleasure, you're way out of balance, you're way out of whack. And we all sort of instinctively recognize that. So this is not a perfect analogy, but I think it's a helpful analogy that when you're enjoying marital intimacy in a way that you know is there's no way that you're going to permit God to bless you with a child if that's his will for you, then it's pure hedonism. And it defeats the purpose of the marital act. So that's why, that's one other reason why she shouldn't do this. Now, thankfully, when people do take this wrong step and have a vasectomy or have their tubes tied simply because they don't want more children, thankfully, we live in a time now where modern medical science has the means of reversing that. And I've even met over the years married couples who have, in some cases, even shed tears as they've told me, I wish somebody had told me this before I did it, or I wish somebody had told me this after I did it, because now it's too late for us to have any more children. And we only had 2 children. We only had 3 children. And we would love to have had more, but no one ever told us. And now we're past the childbearing age. And we can no longer have any children. And for them, it's very, very sorrowful. So it's important that people understand that that's the wrong choice. You're doing something not only that's sinful, but you're also, you're setting yourself up for further problems down the road. So use natural family planning. God designed it. You're not making ill use of a good thing. You're just refraining from using it. It's like fasting from food. So gluttony is bad, bad for your body, bad for your health. But if you fast, it's not like the guy who's eating the food just for the pleasure and then barfing it all back up again. You're actually refraining from eating the food. And you say, for the time being, for today or for tomorrow or for this week, what have you, I'm just going to fast. I'm just going to do without, and you'll be better for it. And you're not committing a sin. And to use that analogy with NFP, you're just saying for this certain amount of time this week or for these many days, we will show our love to each other in other ways, just not that way. And then when finances are easier or the war stops or your health is better, then you can resume having relations in a way that doesn't have to follow this charting to keep track of when ovulation is present. You don't want to do that indefinitely, but the Lord certainly allows you to do that for a time if it's necessary. I hope that helps. Let's go now to Pamela in West Los Angeles. Good morning, Pamela.
Hi, good morning, Patrick.
Good morning.
We know the context of the cross in one where Jesus was crucified and died. What was the context of the cross in Jesus' time when he was teaching his disciples, when he was saying, pick up your cross and follow me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an enigmatic statement because he does say that. He does talk about pick up your cross and follow me. And I presume that they would have been well aware because of the Roman occupation that people were crucified. I mean, it was not an uncommon thing. And if you were in Jerusalem where the Romans had their garrison, you would see people who were crucified. And I believe, as I understand it anyway, that the Via Dolorosa that Jesus himself went through, carrying his cross, or the cross beam perhaps, to the place of his execution, that too would be something people would be familiar with, that you would have to carry your cross to the place where you would be crucified. They would have seen that. And so that being the case, when he said it to them, it wasn't mysterious. It wasn't like, what? What are you talking about? And that would only be the case if, like, Jesus being crucified was the first time any of these people had ever seen that. But they had seen it, and they probably saw it on a regular basis. So I think in context, it would have made sense to them when he said that.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. It's really interesting to see how things are viewed, you know, because now that we know, but believers back then, yeah. All right. Thank you. Hey,
you're welcome. There's a book that you might find interesting. It's called Daily Life in the Time of, is it Daily Life in the Time of Christ or Daily Life in the Time of Jesus? One of the two. I've had it for many years, but the book is written by Jean Danielou. So JeanDanielou. I'm spelling from memory. Jean Danielou. Daily Life in the Time of Christ, I believe it is. And it includes some historical detail about this very issue, about what it was like to live under Roman occupation, and how did the Romans punish insurrection and other crimes. And so it gives you further insight into what it was like in those days. And the book also talks a lot about, like, what did the people wear? What kind of food did they eat? How did they make their living? What were the customs? So it's a fascinating look back into the time of Jesus. I hope that's helpful, Pamela. Thank you. Hey, Nick in California, thanks for waiting. We don't have a lot of time, but welcome. Nick, welcome.
Hey, Patrick.
Hey.
Hey, Patrick. I have a question regarding contraception. So kind of similar to the caller just a couple times ago, but my wife and I, we have two kids, and we've always said that we wanted more kids, but she deals with some like hereditary medical conditions that kind of complicate pregnancy. And during our last pregnancy, she had to spend like 2 weeks in the hospital, and it was kind of like a traumatic pregnancy, I'd say.
Yeah.
And we're wondering now, like, what options we could take regarding potentially like contraception or.
Well, definitely no to contraception. Yeah, forgive my interruption. We're just out of time. But yeah, no to contraception because it is a serious sin. You don't want to do that. But you could use natural family planning. That's certainly licit, certainly not sinful. If you want to, for the purposes of avoiding conception while she's sick, while she's having this medical condition, I don't know if it's permanent or not. But if you practice natural family planning, then you're not doing anything wrong. And you can still enjoy the marriage act, but just at times when it's not likely to conceive. Thanks. Until tomorrow, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me.